I'm Wendy Chamberlain. I'm president of the Middle East Institute, and I'd like to welcome you all on this chilly day, give you a warm welcome. Today's panel will examine the ancient and the contemporary roots of the violent extremist movements that we see in the Middle East today. You know, while terrorist movements in the Middle East are very much in the news today, the context, the roots are lie within the ethnic and the anti-colonial narratives that are centuries old. So a deeper look at these histories and the histories that have become the modern extremist groups provides us with the context to understand the headlines today. Dr. Sandra Schramm, has just written a wonderfully fascinating book, Extremism, Ancient and Modern, Insurgency Terror, and the Empire of the Middle East. I recommend it highly. It's a major contribution to our understanding of these historical roots. She does it from an archaeological perspective, so we're very happy to have her today to discuss her book. The release of Sandra's book coincides with the policy paper that was written by our Vice President for Policy and Research and Programs, Dr. Paul Salem. His paper is called The Rise of Transnational Terrorist Movements in the Middle East, and it delves into some of the more recent causes and drivers of the Middle East transnational terrorist movements. If you haven't already picked up a copy, it's available at the back of the room as you come in. We're also happy to have joining us for this morning's conversation, MEI scholar Hassan Manema. Hassan specializes in radicalism and factionalism in the Middle East and North Africa. Here to moderate the discussion is MEI senior fellow and director of our extremism and counterterrorism program, Charles Lister. Charles' work focuses primarily on the conflict in Syria, and he is also a member of the Middle East Institute's Syria Study Group. Charles frequently contributes and provides briefings to the Congress, to the intelligence community, to the Defense Department, and to other international governments. Before we begin, a little housekeeping. We're filming this and taping it, so please turn off your phones. Some of the rings can disturb others, but keep the phone on. Just mute it, because we do encourage you to tweet, and the hashtag to tweet from is MEI Security. We'd also like to point out that we're in a rented building, and we'll be here for one more year while we reconstruct our headquarters that's right around the corner on N Street. It's going to be fabulous. We're expanding it by over 140%. We'll have a huge conference room, actually larger than this one, a modern art gallery for contemporary and modern art from the Middle East. This takes money. So if you enjoy our programs or remember or frequent what we do, please do consider contributing. We would very much appreciate it. And if you'd like to learn a little bit more about it, we have pamphlets and pledge cards on the table here. So, Charles, let's begin.
Great. Thank you so much, Wendy. I hope everyone can hear me. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I don't want to repeat too much of what Ambassador Chamberlain has just said, but I thought it would be interesting and important for some of you to understand where MEI is coming here, coming at from, within a broader context of just not just this event, but MEI for the last year, nearly year and a half, has been conducting a substantial research project into countering violent transnational movements. And thanks to a very generous grant from the Carnegie Corporation in New York, this project is going to, I think, contribute very substantially towards a more in-depth understanding, not just of the current threats and challenges that we face in terms of extremism across the Middle East and North Africa, but more importantly, understanding what governments can do in the immediate term to try and tackle some of those threats, but even more importantly, understanding the underlying drivers and trends that have fed those challenges that we face in the region, and coming up with more targeted, more durable, more long-term policy solutions to those drivers and trends. And I think this event will very much contribute towards some of that broader understanding, something that I think is all too often lacking in policy-oriented discussions in towns like Washington and elsewhere. But the project itself so far is looking at a number of different issues. One is a very targeted look at extremist movements within the Middle East. Extremist movements not just on with an Islamic extremist orientation, but secularist, nationalist, ethnic-driven movements, etc., etc. As I say, we're also doing a very in-depth look at trends and drivers. One of those in-depth looks was from our colleague here, Paul Salem, his recently published paper. We're also looking and using local scholars and experts to look at the various civil wars and sources of instability in the region and how those have contributed towards fueling the extremist threat and challenges that we face. And then finally, we're also taking a look at one aspect of the challenge which I don't think is often covered, and that's the interrelationship between international law, human rights law, and the challenge of countering terrorism and countering violent extremism. And I think actually that area more than others, having read one paper recently submitted, brings up a lot of very significant challenges to the international community. So, in any case, today we're here to talk about violent extremism, historical patterns and precedents, ancient and modern. I think it's worth just saying here at the outset that a great deal of discussion on these kind of issues of extremism, insurgency, terrorism, all too often focuses, as I say, on the present. Here we're actually going to do a very deep dive into ancient history as well as more recent developments. And I think that, as I say, will contribute a lot more to the depth of this kind of a discussion. It's no secret, as I think Wendy pointed to, extremists, insurgents, terrorists, all across the world frequently use historical precedents, historical narratives, historical grievances to justify their existence, to justify their actions. And I think that's why panels like this are just that much more important than perhaps many of the panels that focus too often on the immediate issues. I was going to introduce all of our panelists, but I think Wendy's introduction has done a very good job on that. So why don't we start with Sandra, and then Paul, and then Hassan, each of which perhaps we can give a sort of introductory comment in terms of, I think you're all going to be looking at this issue from a slightly different perspective. And then we'll go into a discussion after that and then open up to questions and answers. So Sandra, after you. Welcome to MEI.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to see so many people here since it's freezing outside. I'm rather surprised, but the topic that my book is centers around ancient extremism is not usually explored going all the way back to the early Bronze Age. Generally, when people talk about the history of extremism, they're looking at the post-Islamic period, or perhaps even going back to, I've seen a number of books on the Jewish zealots of the first century AD, but usually they don't go back further than that. The reason that, of course, that I'm looking at extremism and its roots back in far ancient history is that it actually does have an effect on the way certain groups look at their background and their history. And this came to me when I started to study the Kurds, and I realized that the Kurdish national anthem, first of all, says, "We are the children of the Medes," which is, if you know the Medes, you know that they're far before the Islamic period. But they actually, if you read some of the websites that the PKK has produced, the PKK is considered a terrorist group by the United States, but not necessarily other countries. But if you look at their website, you will see that they actually trace their roots all the way back to the Stone Age. But they actually find themselves in the early peoples of the mountains, which sort of make up modern Kurdistan, which, as you know, is not really a nation, but parts of a number of modern nation states. So that was my beginning. And of course, I had a background from living in Jerusalem and working with Palestinians and Israeli archaeologists. I've been an archaeologist in the Near East for over 20 years. Of the narratives there. I probably don't need to tell anyone in this group, but obviously Israelis consider the Iron Age, very ancient history, to be very important to their identity. Palestinians similarly have found their roots in the Canaanite period, going way back before the Israelites, or in the Philistine period. Now, many Israelis scoffed at the idea that that Palestinians thought that they had some affinity with the Philistines. But I think the problem here is that they weren't looking at this narrative from the point of view of culture. Basically, Palestinians were sincere about the narratives. They couldn't necessarily prove it genetically or even archaeologically or historically, but they were very sincere about the narrative. And that's the important thing about these narratives. They're probably, for the most part, not what you would consider to be objective truth, but they speak to modern modern extremist groups, for want of a better term. but I actually consider these groups to be insurgents more than extremists, but they're called extremists. They speak to modern extremist groups because they tell them a story of how they came to be where they are, how their grievances developed. I actually prefer the term injustice to grievance just because I'm looking at it from their perspective. Grievances don't cause outrage. Injustices do. So that's why I make that distinction. We would call them grievances. That's typically what counterterrorism, the counterterrorism jargon does. So the other point I want to make about this is that in the book, I look at what is called, what I call rooted extremism. In other words, I'm not looking at foreign fighters or even necessarily transnational movements, though to some extent I do touch on those. Not at ISIS or Al-Qaeda necessarily, but at groups like Hamas and the PKK and the so-called Sinai Bedouin insurgency. These are what I call rooted extremisms. They're in and of the land. They're part of the Middle East. They're the groups that are part of that part of the scene of extremism are actually made up of indigenous people who can trace their roots way back. So these deep historical narratives do matter. Living in the Middle East, there's one thing I discovered very early is that people there have very long memories. They're still angry about the Crusades, many, but go back even before that. And of course, beyond the whole idea of the Israeli, of the nation state of Israel being founded on Iron Age premise of a kingdom of David and Solomon, actually, you know, people have long memories and they do revere ancient history. So with that, I think I'll just let other people talk, and I suppose we'll have questions later.
Great.
Thank you. And I mean, reading Sandra's fascinating book is a sort of lovely journey back into linking the ancient past, which is not so ancient, as you said, in people's memories, to modern times. My paper looked at sort of the 20th century and how it affects where we are today. But one main link is that early in the 20th century, attempts to build national identity after the Ottoman period and in sort of contrast to Arab nationalist movements and some of the colonial movements, obviously Egypt harks back to its old pharaonic past and still does as part of its national identity. Iraq, certainly under Saddam Hussein and even a bit previously. And I was just in Baghdad visiting the National Museum. You know a lot about the Mesopotamian history and the history of Iraq in those ancient ages is a big part of an attempt at building a national identity. Lebanon, many Lebanese tried to hark back to Phoenician times. So it's still a part of the narrative even in the 20th century. I'm going to talk about four points that I touch on in the paper. One is low nation state legitimacy in the Arab world. Two, the roots of legitimacy for armed non-state actors. and three, the collapse of states, and four, proxy conflict, regional conflict. And I identify those four things to help explain that while there are violent transnational movements, or you might call them terrorist groups, all over the world and throughout history, why are there so many in today's Middle East? What's peculiar about that? So the first dynamic I talk about is low nation-state legitimacy. The Arab state system was born in denial, and you know everybody knows the story. And the whole ideological mood of the time was to deny the definition of the nations that were created and to deny sort of the structure of the states that were put in place, which were seen as colonial or cooperating with colonial. So born in denial. This involved continuing contestation of what is a nation in the Arab world. You see it from the Arab nationalists all the way to ISIS. Is it based on religion? Is it based on Arab language? Is it based on borders? Is it based that there simply is a state there, like the Hashemite kingdom in Jordan, so that's the nation? That issue has not yet been resolved in the Arab world, except in some countries where clear, like Egypt and others, where that's really not much of an issue. So contestation of what is a nation. Contestation over what is a state. In other words, what form does the state take? Is it to be democratic? Is it to be revolutionary, authoritarian, and aiming for some future goals? How Islamic is it going to be? How secular is it going to be? While that, similarly in Europe, maybe that took centuries to work itself out, it finally reached some kind of conceptualization after 1945. In the Arab world, up till today, March 2018, we're still haven't resolved should the state be authoritarian, conservative, religious, secular, so and how does it function, and how democratic or not is it? Then there is contestation over the regime that controls the state. That, take a case like Syria, a lot of the fight is, well, who calls the shot? Who calls the shots within the state? Yes, there's some disagreement, should be Islamic, not Islamic, whatnot. But there's also contestation of who runs it. And that's a third level of contestation, particularly since there's no agreed system to decide who runs it, which would normally be either a monarchical system or a democratic system. And this crisis of the state reached a very deep kind of crisis in the 1970s. A, the nationalist goals of the Arab states did not come to fruition. There was no Arab unity, no recovery of Palestine, no standing up to colonialism and so on. So the ideological goals collapsed. The socioeconomic project, which saw a lot of progress in the 50s and 60s, stumbled in the 70s and unraveled in the 80s and 90s. So people said, well, as long as we're having schools and jobs and healthcare and everything, we'll go along with it. That began to unravel. And the legitimacy of the regimes which were promising socioeconomic development or nationalist victory, switched from conviction about those goals to more of a police state sort of repressive. So the state, since the late 70s, has been in crisis. The second dynamic is legitimacy or roots of legitimacy for armed non-state actors. Now, one can go back to the early 20th century, the Arab revolt, the Syrian revolt in the 20s, and then in the 50s and 60s, Algerian revolt, Libyan revolt, a lot of popular movements, either against early times the Ottomans or against colonial French forces. So in the first half of the 20th century up to the 60s, there was a lot of ideological legitimacy for those armed non-state actors who were seen as doing great and heroic things. But the modern hero would, from the 70s, late 60s, 70s, would be the PLO, Righteous Cause. After the failure of the Arab states to liberate Palestine, PLO, an armed non-state actor, became sort of the superhero of the Arab world, and sort of in harmony with models like the Cuban Revolution in Cuba or the Vietnamese or the Cambodians and others, within a broad ideology that armed non-state actors are the most legitimate actors in positive change. You get then a new iteration of that with Hezbollah in 2000, the only movement to defeat or to push out an Israeli occupation by force. And then in 2006, the only state or non-state actor, in this case a non-state actor, to stand up and fight the Israeli army either to a standoff or to a defeat, depending on how you want to call it. And for a while there, enormous popularity of Hezbollah as a super successful movement against Israel. So there's an openness to that. Maybe something that Al-Qaeda tried to, you know, erupt into after 2001 and so on, but then it takes us into a different trajectory. But I wanted to emphasize that armed non-state actors have a long, legitimate history in the region. Third factor is obviously the collapse of states. It's important to say that no armed non-state actor has been able to take a foothold except in countries that have already collapsed, effectively, either partially or completely. In the Arab world, Hezbollah was PLO first, and then Hezbollah was able to take, you know, strong roots in a collapsed state, which was Lebanon, and thrive there. And then conditions after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, full or partial collapse in Iraq, Al-Qaeda is able to move from Afghanistan to Iraq, then uprising, collapse in Syria, partial or full, they are able to move into Syria as well. So it is the condition of full or partial collapse of states that enables armed non-state actors to take the lead. And that, you know, reflects what one might say about long-term remedies. The fourth and final factor I'll mention is the intense regional proxy rivalry. That really goes back to 1979 and what I call the weaponization of sectarian identity. And this goes back to a number of obvious dynamics, the Islamic Revolution of Iran, which had a vision of an expansionist vision, or at least a global vision of Islamism, Shiite and otherwise, and a reaction from Saudi Arabia to that. Same year, the Soviet Union invades Afghanistan, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia begin weaponizing Sunni jihadist identity to fight the Soviets. Same year, Sunni radicals take over the mosque in Mecca. The royal family goes more Islamist in order to react to that. Same year, Egypt completely withdraws from the Arab world after its separate peace with Israel. So Egypt's secular sort of nationalist voice is completely lost. And the region then, for the next 40 years almost, is dominated by two petrostates, and this is the oil boom of the 70s, so wealth was now with Saudi Arabia and Iran, who are fueling competing narratives of sectarian identity and arming it in many ways. So those are the conditions that I wanted to mention. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Paul.
Well, we have two different works here with two different methodologies, but ultimately contributing to a crucial debate that I do not think has been resolved in terms of assessing the place of Islam in particular in terrorism, extremism, name it what you want. I would say just as an aside before I proceed, meaning on the work of Dr. Sham, we have had over the course of the decades a number of works that have pushed beyond the tipping point of existing research and caused a lot of controversy, and actually works of substance. I'm thinking, for example, of Hegelism of Krohn and Cook. I'm thinking of Orientalism of Edward Said. But also I'm thinking of Timothy Mitchell's Colonizing Egypt. In all three cases, what we're dealing with is scholarship that is breaking new ground, not completely, but nonetheless daring to proceed. In some cases, succeeding in changing the landscape, such as in Said's case. In other cases, less so. I would place definitely your work in that category. In that sense, it's a seminal work that ought to be read. Not that it covers the promise of what it does, but what it does is crucial, especially in the light light of the fact that very often the periodization of Middle Eastern history and the scholarship associated with this periodization has led to a segmentation that is unfair. Anything that's post-Islamic and anything that's pre-Islamic is effectively treated as separate beasts altogether, and very rarely creating those bridges that effectively in this book we see
case studies and not a complete overview of. And in that sense, I think it's an extremely important book. I'm mentioning this because the link between the two is a question when we're dealing with issues of extremism, a question of how we prioritize culture versus structure. In the case of Paul, what Paul has provided is a sober, lucid case for structure. He basically establishes very clearly, give me a failed state, give me the lack of components for legitimacy, I'll give you a terrorist organization. I mean, in a, well, the problem that Dr. Shem is dealing with is slightly different. Are we talking about cultural continuities or are we talking about structural affinities? Do we have, as a result of empire, as a result of conquest, do we have patterns that are ingrained in the terrain, in society, in the ecology, or do we have, as she calls it in the book at one point, reverberations from the past? Well, because the book offers case studies, it's difficult to get an answer, but it's an invitation for an answer. I think what may be important is to lay it, and I wish the in addition to the first couple of chapters, which were very much so Western critique of Western approaches to the subject, and were really not about the subject matter. I mean, the other chapters are. The epilogue actually is a reprise of the beginning chapters and more contextualization in today. I wish there were another chapter that actually establishes a little bit of a context in the region. The Medes, Kurds and the Medes, are one last episode of a series of such appropriations that maybe starts with the Chaldeans and the Uniate Eastern Church that basically in Cyprus the Pope decided, why don't you claim your Chaldean origin, although there was no connection there. This is why we have today, for example, we have an Assyrian ethnicity, if you'd like, that is actually Western Semitic, not Eastern Semitic, but Assyrian or Neo-Assyrian nonetheless. This is why we have, in the case of Egypt, for example, the discontinuity in Egyptian history in terms of pre-Christian Egypt, in Pharaonic Egypt, and the Hellenization of Egypt was a deliberate effort on the part of the church, but today the Coptic church is the claimant of that pre-discontinuity heritage, while actually the Muslim majority in Egypt is a claimant of a history of Hijaz, not of Egypt, to a larger extent, in terms of the historical memory. The reason all of this ends up being important in here is because the whole notion of seeking roots of legitimacy, seeking elements of legitimacy, has been done by elites along the lines of trying to claim this ancient heritage. Actually, we can hear that the European model is clearly what has been emulated starting with the 19th century. I'm thinking, for example, about Greece, the recently independent Greece of the early 19th century, stripping away, literally, its Ottoman layers of history by exposing the heritage, the Hellenic and Hellenistic heritage, and destroying what is in between that and today in order to claim back its European pedigree. I'm thinking of actually very much so the construction of the neo-Berber, the Amaziga identity of disparate groups, but now which is trying to claim Tifinagh as an ancestral language, never as an ancestral script, it never was, trying to create an identity which definitely they would not go to the Muwahhidun and Murabitun that you study, because there is a need to separate from that, not to claim that. So what I think is important in this context not to miss is the way even the Islamist narrative, even the Zionist narrative, the Jewish narrative, fit into the same pattern, a pattern of rediscovery and not a pattern of long memory. I'll just here comment on one incident that is actually important, and I'll leave it at that, the whole notion of, well, we have long memories, we have never forgotten the Crusades. Not true. The Crusades were not in the memory from the time they happened till the 19th century. In the 19th century, they were discovered. If you look at the narratives, I'm talking here about the historical narrative, even in the times of the Crusades, the fear and the attention was not towards the West. Yes, that was a nuisance. That very important action that Europe has engaged in to try to occupy the Holy Land was a mere nuisance from the point of view of many. I know that Amin Maalouf has compiled a book in order to say otherwise, but the main focus was the East and what was coming from the East. A devastating storm coming from the East, that of the Mongols, that was an existential threat, not a nuisance, to the Islamic continuity, and therefore that was the focus. They were the French, they were not the Salibiyun. They were never thought of as people of the cross. They were French, meaning coming from Europe. And they were thought of as being, really, you deal with them, lots of little principalities, lots of little counties, you deal with them, but ultimately the threat is towards the East. Now, when in the 19th century a victorious Europe decided to reclaim its crusader heritage, the grievance or the injustice was extended to the past. I would argue that the Islamist narrative, even in its totality, the whole notion of a just Khulafa' al-Rashidun and their just rule and what comes next, etc., all of it fits the same pattern of projecting into the past and constructing what amounts ultimately a way to root legitimacy. And therefore, I would not limit it to the Kurds and the Berbers and to anyone. I would say this effort at trying to deconstruct narrative of continuity in culture ought to be viewed as part of really the imperative of structure that seems to impose it. I'll stop at that.
Thank you. Fascinating. I'm sat here thinking my day-to-day job is talking about rebel group A and rebel group B in village C and D, and this is something completely different, but it's absolutely fascinating. I'm going to start with a question for each of you, and then I've got one for all three together. But I'll start with you, Sandra. I think if I understood you correctly, you were making a distinction, at least in terms of what you focused on your book, that you focused more on sort of nationally focused movements and their roots in history. But what struck me through the rest of your comments and also other things that Hassan and Paul said is, of course, the importance of culture, which, at least to me as a sort of outside observer from your work, seems to be something that crosses nation-state boundaries. So is there, beyond your book, is there a way that you can comment a little bit more about, I think you used the term rooted extremism in the way that it's a sort of in and of the land. But of course the nation state system is a pretty new reality. So how does that kind of interrelation between a nationally focused movement that nevertheless focuses on a kind of cultural precedent that stands beyond national borders? I wonder if you could just comment a little bit more about that.
Well, full disclosure, I'm an anthropological archaeologist, and anthropologists don't believe in nation states. I guess invented traditions, but beyond that, yes, nation states, of course, exist. Yet culture certainly is a big part of the way I look at these movements. I should also say that the reason I started looking at these narratives and how important they were for the culture is because I worked on researching countering violent extremism programs for the Department of State. So basically, and part of my, to go to your point, part of my critique, I didn't do the Crusades in the book, by the way, so but I do appreciate your correction. Part of my critique of Western perspectives on this has to do with that work, because I realized these programs did not work. Counter-narratives did not work. Narratives, in order to be adopted, to be for someone to believe in them, they have to be sincere, and counter narratives are not sincere. They're just sort of constructed by nation states in order to counter ideas. For example, that the West is at war with Islam. I guess that I heard that phrase very many times while I was working on these programs. So, and they were all predicated on that notion. And of course, all of these programs take place within the country. They don't study foreign fighters or any trans some transnational movements, but mostly the programs focus within specific countries.
Okay.
So that's why I started from the point of view of culture. In a way, it's nationally bound, except for the Kurdish instance. But it certainly does, you know, transcend national boundaries in most of the cases.
Right. Okay. Thank you so much. And Paul, I was, you know, struck by your sort of more contemporaneous discussion of more modern history, and how, again, as I was saying in the earlier question, that does lie more within the existence of the nation state, and one of the big sort of impetus and catalysts for increased research in this whole subject has been that we've seen one movement arise in the last few years who sought to completely destroy that entire reality. ISIS in 2014 spoke about nothing much more than destroying the borders, dissolving the borders. And so that plays into all kinds of other, you know, more historical issues of culture, of religion, of other sort of driven, rooted narratives. So I wonder whether I could challenge you to look beyond the or further back behind modern history. And is there a precedent for another movement like that that really sought to so fundamentally challenge the way that sort of the existing status quo was for people? So the political status quo, if I can put it that way. And if anyone else on the panel wants to answer that question, I realize it's a tough one. But it struck me as such a significant challenge in the Middle East. And something that, at least as far as I can see, I'm struggling to come up with another example of a movement that so significantly sought to transform the status quo within a region, within a nationally focused reality.
Good question. Interesting
Iran?
One. But I mean, as ISIS in particular, because it tried to establish an actual society, a nation and state, and so on, and claiming, and they issued currency and whatnot. I mean, obviously, they are harking back, as Hassan said, to their version of, you know, the original Islamic order and so on. But one would have to say historically that the Arab conquest under the banner of Islam in the 7th century was a very sort of clear and successful program to transform what was a kind of Greco-Roman situation contested by the Persians for a long time into a completely different different order. Now, one can go into the history of and the details that actually the Arab-Islamic conquest was much less transformative and radical than what ISIS was proposing. Sure. I mean, it ended up being somewhat imperial in nature, the Arab-Islamic conquest. They didn't, they didn't effectively transform things in any urgent way. They took over sort of as an elite and set up a new imperial system, but one could hark back to that, one could hark back to the Greco-Roman conquests and so on. But, I mean, to link also a bit to part of your question, that their ability to propose a complete reordering, not only of borders, but of orders. And this is where, I mean, yes, there's contestation about the border. It should be here or there, and that's where, you know, they had that in spades. But they were contesting also the order. What is a state? How is it organized? How is it legitimized? What are its laws? What are its rules? And they contested the social order, that women must play this role, dress my... So it was a deeply totalitarian attempt to change absolutely everything. And I link that to the weakness in the contemporary Arab world of fully legitimizing the borders and the orders. Yeah. And the particular collapse that happened after 2003 and 2011.
Sure. Okay, very good. Hassan, I was wondering if I could sort of exploit your knowledge of Islamism and the sort of evolution of various Islamist movements through history and challenge you with another question, which is something that's been on my mind for a while, which is that there have been a number of sort of Salafi jihadi ideologues or thinkers in the region who, over the last 12 months or so, have been talking increasingly through gritted teeth about how they have to accept, as veterans of the struggle from earlier on, that there is this kind of new third way emerging, which is Salafi jihadism, for want of a better term, that embraces or limits itself or constrains itself to within a nationally focused theater or reality. So they are an armed movement, they are an armed non-state movement that embraces an ideology that traditionally has been focused on transnationalism, breaking down borders, operating globally within that kind of a reality. But there's this new third way that's being experimented with, that's limiting that within a national focus in an attempt to become more effective, more inviting, more popular. In some of my writings, I've said this could be the big new threat that we all face as nation states, because it does have a demonstrated ability to be more popular. But I just wonder whether you, as an expert that incorporates a lot more history than I do, whether you think that has any chance of being a popular movement, whether there are simply too many internal contradictions for that to actually succeed.
All of Dr. Sham's book was interesting, but one chapter that was particularly interesting to me was on the Houthis, mm-hmm. and the rather ambiguous relationship with the Hemirites. Mm-hmm. The reason I'm mentioning it in answer to your question is there has been no Islamist movement that was able to root itself or derive any kind of structural legitimacy, if you'd like, from anything other than the episode of the Prophet in Mecca and its aftermath. Okay, and therefore, especially in terms of Salafists, because Salafism has built into it mechanism to deny it the ability to evolve, mm-hmm. because you have the limitation that is immediately applied. Notice that the Islamic Republic and the Islamic State are the two models, both of them rooted in the same episode, but each one of them claiming a different way of reaching it. Now, people have argued and actually pointed to the fact that the Islamic Republic, in more ways than one, I'm talking about Iran, has been almost like a cover for an Iranian nationalism or an Iranian imperialism even, etc. I would contest that, because I think that there's a lot of sincere desire to remain within the notion of the Islam of Muhammad and Ali. So it's not an attempt. Nonetheless, I would say there has been undercurrents of ambiguity and dichotomy that allowed for both the boasting about a third Persian Empire that reaches the Mediterranean, while at the same time seeking to have that narrative rooted in Muhammadan and Ali Islam, you see. I would say within Salafism, and even within the Islamic State, which tried to be as pure as possible, there was also that dichotomy and some might say hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. Because on the one hand, you're the negation of the world order, and you've had young people, Shar'iyin, Abu Sa'ab al-Tunsi is one of them, who had declared Osama bin Laden kafir because he has not spoken against the Taliban's opening a delegation that effectively met with the United Nations, meaning that level of intransigence. I think when you declare Osama bin Laden not strict enough, I think, or for that matter, you reject him, it's an indication of how far you go. Nonetheless, that same Islamic State actually dealt with Turkey, dealt with the regime in Syria, dealt with the Iraqis of all sorts, accepted money from Gulf states, all of them for that matter, not just the Qataris, you see. So we're talking about, is this hypocrisy or where do you draw the line? Right. So I would say any attempt on the part of Salafists as opposed to other type of Islamists, because Islamism is a whole range, mm-hmm. any attempt on the part of Salafists to try to root themselves locally would be faced with the resistance from within, mm-hmm. that you cannot do that because you cannot recognize the order, and therefore that might push towards movements that are non-Salafist but still Islamist.
Right, exactly. The reason why that answer is so interesting is because that's already what we're starting to see happen. So before we open up to questions and answers, I wanted to pose a single question to all of you, or a single challenge to all of you. So this discussion so far has been more rooted in history, more rooted in culture, more rooted in things that to a policymaker would seem quite abstract. And MEI is both an academic institution and a policy-focused institution, so I'm going to ask a policy question. How would each of you translate what you have presented so far into something meaningful towards facing down, dealing with, ameliorating the various challenges that we have, not just necessarily today, but as I said in my introductory remarks, you know, setting us up for a more durable, long-term way of solving some of these issues. I mean, are they just always going to exist? If so, say that. But if there are lessons that you can draw from all of your research and this discussion so far that would be useful to a policymaker, what would those recommendations be? That's a challenging question to start with, but more than happy to go in reverse order if you want.
Well, I have actually thought about and discussed this a lot just because of my work, mm-hmm. And actually we had a parade of specialists come in to talk to us, and there the consensus was, it's really quite difficult. As I said, I can tell you what doesn't work. Quite difficult, almost impossible. What doesn't work are the current approaches. The international development programs that people have relabeled counterterrorism programs. I mean, basically they're just economic programs, but this is, you know, this is our approach. English language study, all of these things. This, you know, it's maybe a good thing. There may be good things in themselves, but I don't think they really do much to ameliorate any kind of violence that's happening in the countries where we're doing these programs. So I actually, as an anthropologist, think that what Western nations really need is a deeper, very deeper understanding of the cultures of these regions before embarking on any kind of initiatives. Now, I mean, admittedly, it's my field, so. but that is the one takeaway I would. I think that. I think my students, when I teach at Catholic University, I've never had a class of students that had anything beyond a really shallow understanding of the Middle East or interest in it. And it's just, if we are going to focus on this region, we really have to understand it on a cultural level much more deeply.
Yeah, I mean, of the four factors I mentioned, the first two are more, like you say, cultural, but are more soft issues of legitimacy and narratives and history, and you know, economics and all of that. Those are long-term things that, you know, one cannot address in any quick policy. But the second two, which is collapsed states and a region at war with itself, those are definitely more structural, and those are ones that one could imagine ending and changing. In some cases, rather rapidly and decisively. So the first one of those two would be ending civil wars and helping rebuild collapsed states, or help reconstitute collapsed states. In Yemen and Libya, that's not such a long shot. I mean, you know, there's even this year things could happen in terms of a negotiated end. You know, where are the resources to help them rebuild? That's a discussion. But civil wars do end. And these two are not far from that. Iraq is on the tail end. I mean, Iraq has defeated ISIS, is not in civil war, has the capacity to move forward. It's ahead of the others. That needs to be consolidated and make sure it doesn't disintegrate again. But a stabilized, inclusive Iraqi state with an effective national armed forces can keep terrorist groups at bay. And, you know, that's a fact. The big one is Syria, of course, which is not seemingly amenable to any ending at this point. But it just goes to say that there is no way to eradicate terrorist groups if you still have ongoing civil wars and failed states in territory the size of, you know, Western France or something. So you got to get that right, close up the space. Now, people are going to have grievances, injustice is going to continue forever. But those structures of existing fairly stable states was there just a few years ago. So it's not like a dream, and it needs to be reconstructed in a new way. The second part, which is doable, the region fell into proxy war not even in 1979. Those were the roots. But really in 2003 with the invasion of Iraq and then empowerment of Iran there. And now we're in a full-fledged Iranian slash others, you know, from Yemen to Syria to Lebanon, maybe Bahrain, are at risk as well. And that is not an inevitability. A few decades ago, the proxy war was between Nasser's Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and there was civil war in Yemen, revolutions, coup d'etats all over the place, and that ended. So at ending the Iranian regional conflict is something here at MEI that we attempt through our Track 2 dialogues, and we've written a book about it, mm-hmm. From Chaos to Cooperation, with my colleague Ross Harrison. That is a not an inconceivable win. So ending regional proxy war and ending civil wars, that'll give you 80% of your win right there.
Right. I'm with Paul on this. Meaning, I think ultimately it is a matter of structure first and foremost. The debate about the role of culture in this is actually can be divided. The debate is of three points of view. One that says actually that culture will simply follow structure, just focus on the concrete, and once you create stable states, stable societies, culture will emerge elements that effectively correct the current imbalance. Another goes the other extreme and says, no, as a matter of fact, you have to deal with the fact that Islam today is not what Islam was a century ago. It is radicalized, it has a certain view, and therefore you have to address it, and you have to promote moderate Islam. By doing that, actually, you give legitimization to the notion that Islamists represent all of the underlying populations, and therefore you create a vicious cycle in which any moderation or any attempt at creating a moderate form is going to be fought as being another invasion, neo-imperialism, etc. The third, maybe in between the two notions, would be to realize that, yes, after all, these are cultural expressions, meaning I'm talking about Islamism, radicalism, Salafism, etc., but it is a culture that has created its own structure. I mean, it's most salient in the case of Saudi Arabia, where actually the al-Sheikh have become what is today a Wahhabi establishment, that by virtue of the if you'd like, the cycle, the economic cycle that they live with, I mean, revenue and then education, mosques elsewhere, it is a structure to promote a culture. And therefore, maybe you address it at that level, not that at the level of challenging ideas. You let that to the society, but you challenge it at the level of ensuring that there is no parasitic expansion, if you'd like. However, all of this taken into account, the fact that it remains at the end that it's a question of agency, meaning the whole notion that it is, if you do not find local agency, and that agency was presented itself in the form of young people in 2011 who said, okay, we need change, but we've decided not to focus on them or to focus on others. So maybe not to miss opportunities is also part of the equation.
Okay, fantastic, great. Excellent discussion so far. I'm sure there's going to be lots of questions. I'd just ask you, before I pick anyone out, please introduce yourself when you start. I think we'll take one at a time for now, and then I'll sort of get an idea of how many more we've got to go. So we'll start with this gentleman here on the inside. We do have a microphone. So.
Thank you very much. My name is Hisham Jabi. I work at Tetratech MSI in Washington. And when you talk about culture and history, you took me back 30, 35 years ago when I was a child growing up in a small town in Nablus in the northern part of the West Bank, where I come from. And what came to my mind really, a very interesting term, the word haram. And the definition of haram in English is forbidden, basically, right? Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Something more or not. And it's a very religious term. And, you know, everything I did or any simple argument I had with my brother, my sister, anybody, my neighbors, haram, walak haram. It's just unbelievable, very strong. That actually took me to what Dr. Salim said about constitution. To me, you have constitution in Egypt and Jordan and everywhere. It's wonderful in Tunisia also, but it's superficial because there is a very strong confusion still going on since Prophet Muhammad. I think haram is a wonderful word, don't take me wrong, because it creates some conscience for people what to do. It has negative and positive implication. But the whole notion of your relationship with yourself, your relationship with others, your relationship with God, and your relationship with the state has a very, very strong sense of confusion. And your discussion triggered that. I never understand it. I never understand what's going on. Because anybody can use the word haram because it works for his benefit or her benefit. And that's to me, is very confusing. With all these superficial constitution we have across the Arab world, I have not seen Islam integrated into a modern state structure that makes sense to me. At least I'm just talking from my own experience as somebody who grew up there. And thank you.
Great. And that words do not have eternal meanings. Even the word haram. In the 20th century, before, if you'd like, the resurgence of Islamism, had moved from the forbidden to the morally unsuitable. Don't hit him, haram, matudurbu, haram. It does not mean don't hit him, God will punish you. Don't hit him, it's not morally suitable. Actually, that semantic shift happened across what used to be in the past terminology that's associated with the fiqh. It happened to the point where the word jihad means struggle. Christians and Muslims would have their children named jihad. When an organization in Palestine decided to act on matters of jihad, they had to specify jihad Islami, as opposed to the other types of jihad, which were the jihad. That at that point, jihad had lost its religious meaning even. What I'm referring to here, we're not talking, when you said it goes back to the Prophet Muhammad, we do not know how many times it has shifted in meaning. We know that in the 20th century, the pre-Islamist 20th century, it had a meaning, and now it is all sorts of notions are being redefined. Ummah, when we say Ummah al-Islamiyya, this is another example of a word that had lost its meaning as Ummah, meaning the body nation of Muslims, because Ummah became nation. You see, so we're witnessing some change. I mean, we know that Muhammad bin Salman is intent on trying to reshuffle the whole thing. Maybe it's too optimistic, maybe it's too simplistic, but it is not that far-fetched when you think about it, because it has happened quite a number of times in our lifetime.
Let me also comment on that, because the very interesting themes. I mean, we're talking sort of about history, and one might get the impression that history is sort of a fixed thing. But, I mean, the one consistent thing about history is that it's change. It's always about change. And I'm not just talking about our memory of history, but actual history. And when you think of things like states, and you refer to constitutions, meaning the state, and you look at the emergence of the nation state in Europe, it was a tremendously difficult, impossible, revolutionary, bloody, and still in some cases playing itself out. It's not something, first of all, unique to the Middle East or the Arab world. And history has these forces of change that are happening everywhere, maybe at different timetables, that hit the Middle East in the 19th and 20th century. And now we've been hit by a technological wave which further changes the structures and the power shifts. And what I want to point to is what the power is about is not just the state and the people. That is a well-known thing. It's been going on since the Ottomans and, you know, revolts against various rulers. But what we've seen more recently is shifts of power in society. A, the empowerment of women, which has caused an enormous backlash from men, under the various guises, from the extremism of ISIS to other forms, the empowerment of young people who have now the entire world in their phone, the ability to know everything and to mobilize. And forget the state. The society has not been able to keep up with what this means. And as Hassan was saying, haram had become a social term. It didn't mean that the sheikh is going to create a sharia thing against you. It's that we don't do that as a family or something. That is now being torn asunder, which is why some of the reactions like ISIS, they're so virulent, because it's not just a revolt against the state. Oh, we don't like the borders, we want to change the borders. We don't like the borders, we don't like the state, we don't like the people, we don't like the women, we don't like everything. And it gets very, very violent when you're rebelling against absolutely everything.
Please, I'll take a question from this gentleman at the front to start with, and then I'm going to broaden it out. promise.
And Paul gets a voice because he's married to the scholar.
Please.
Thank you so much. My name is Ayman Youssef. I'm from Egypt. Thank you for the interesting, really, presentation, and Dr. Sham also. My inquiry, actually, regarding the causes and the solution of the phenomenon of the violent movement in the Middle East, because all the factors mentioned by distinguished podium today mention many factors, but really, I think the key factor and the key solution should be directed to the ideology. Because if we look at all the violent movement in the Middle East, Al-Qaeda, Daesh, Murabitun, Shabab, Boko Haram, all of these actually are linked and they are coming from the same rooted ideology. So without looking and find a way to counter the disrupted ideas and the disrupted message of those groups, will never be able to defeat or reduce the violent movement in the Middle East. So I think I need actually your comment on that. How do you think actually we should counter the disrupted message of the terrorist and violent movement in the Middle East? And how do you see it as a cause and a solution? And I don't like to take more time, but if one quick thing, when we actually, the whole world is fighting Daesh, killing 1,000 every week or every month, they recruit much more, not only in Syria and Iraq, but also in Europe, in many Western countries, and they started their action there. So the idea is the ideology. What do you think about that, and do you think it's a solution and a cause or not? Thank you.
I tell you what, I will take two more questions. So we'll go with Paul. Who's, as another Paul said, is married to one of the panelists.
Leave you to guess which one.
Yeah, you can guess which one I'm married to. I'm Polish, I'm a scholar here at MEI, and I wanted to mention, if you're interested in the book, there are some copies there, and discount flyers. But my question is, Charles asked you to expand the idea chronologically, backwards and forwards. But this seems a very Middle Eastern phenomenon, and only Middle Eastern. I think there isn't another region in the world where you have many of the same dynamics going on. And I'd like anyone who wants to either challenge that or say, why in the Middle East, why is it special? It wasn't the only colonized area. It has other things in common. Japan and China and Korea have ancient narratives, but there the states are strong. So I wonder what analogies, if any, can be made.
Great. And then one more, the woman here in the middle, please.
My name is Manal Taha. I'm working for United States Institute of Peace, and I'm doing CVE and anthropologist as well. I do research in Sahel region in Africa, and it's not... when I look at the history of the region, it's not different from what's happening in the Middle East. You have the kingdom of the Ottoman Danfodio, which also expanded, and they did a lot of brutal killing for under their expanding and Islamic ideology. Also, we have in Sudan, originally in Sudan, we have the Mahdi movement, which is also ideological movement, and they kill and innovated others. That's not different from many, like what's happening now in the Sahel region in terms of a lot of violent extremist groups moving there, ISIS or Qaeda or Ansarul Islam or مخطئ المرابطون. So all of them, they have the same what's happening in the past in the region. So it's not merely in the Middle East. I'm wondering about the issue of the in the Middle East. I don't really have a lot of knowledge about what's happening there. But as far as I know, during the if we talk about the ancients, and the Turks when they tried to expand, they went to the what we call it now the Republic of Georgia, and they innovated the nations there. The Christian nations, and they took their children, Seljuk, to and trained them, and then later they became the Mamalik, and they just expand their authority around the region using those group of military. To what extent you think that actually it's about masculine and authoritarian expanding and economic benefits more than actually ideologically? It's just ideologically, the ideology is being used to expand these benefits. And privilege, so they will not lose. And also, I want to ask about the Hazara in Afghanistan, how they've been killed in the past because they are retaliating for the something happening 600 years before from Sunni. So it's moved back and forth about expanding authority. And as you said, it's against women, against young guys, and it's merely that means masculine authority approach. So.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, so plenty to cover. We'll start with Sandra and we'll move left.
Well, I may be wrong, but I think all three questions in some ways focused on the idea of ideology and what kind of ideology we are dealing with here and also what can be done in order to counter the more virulent and violent ideologies. I actually think the reason that the Middle East has this unusual, I do agree that in Africa these things are happening as well because I work in Africa, but the Middle East does have, and I hate to say this because I criticize this model, but it does have this succession of empires past. In fact, a friend of mine once did a presentation, History of the Middle East in 2 minutes, and just sort of put a map up and put all the different empires on it. and it took about 2 minutes, and it covered almost all of them. The problem is, looking at it through that imperial lens, I think that this is a construct of Western history. But to some extent, I think the imperialism ideology, which I characterize as perhaps something that ISIS might have adopted in some ways, that the imperialism ideology is considered to be, by Westerners, endemic to the Middle East, but perhaps not so much until recently has it necessarily caught on with other movements. We're talking about ISIS here. I mean, in the book I cover a variety of other movements that are quite different in terms of the ideology. The Kurds, for example, completely secular, or not completely, but generally secular. It's in a movement that in which women are empowered and many other ways different from ISIS, but I guess that's how I would characterize the ideology. I think the imperialism and insurgency cycle in the Middle East is unique, interesting, and perhaps in some ways, shall we say, destabilizing.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, in terms of the question of addressing the ideology. I mean, I would say that one of the quick fixes to limit things is to address the structure, rebuild states that are stable and somewhat inclusive so that there isn't space for a virulent ideology to take over of a, space the size of Belgium or something. And that metaphor to me is sort of like the public health metaphor, that the Ebola virus is always going to be out there somewhere, but if your public health system collapses, everybody's going to die of Ebola. So you treat the public health system to keep that society, safe from that. On the combating of the ideology itself, say a couple of things. One is, sort of in today's world, the ideologies are always going to exist somewhere. There are always going to be some people who are not going to be convinced. But it is true, and this gets to Hassan's point about addressing the structures that produce the culture. It's no coincidence that the eclipse of Al-Azhar and even, you know, the university in Tunis, which used to be a, you know, a lighthouse of interpretations of Islam, obviously the collapse of Istanbul and the whole Ottoman thing, and the shift to the Wahhabi version and so on after the late 70s and the petrostates. That structure and the fact that, you know, from the 80s onwards, most imams trained and there, not here, that tells you already a lot of what's going on. And I'm very heartened, and as Hassan mentioned this, that hopefully the Crown Prince is recognizing this, and he said it several times, that was a mistake, we've got to shift from that. And that is a big factor. And I would say particularly, this is a much bigger challenge in the Sunni world, where there isn't a reference point. You know, it's contested in its profundity. And hence, any group can say, no, I am the caliph, no, you're the caliph, no, I interpret, no, you interpret. In the Shiite world, with all of its problems, and it does have several marja'iyas, but it is certainly much more, you know, contained, let's say. So I would agree that there's something to be done there, particularly at the structural level. On sort of Paul's question of why is it that the Middle East has all of these things? Well, first of all, the Middle East in just recently didn't have all of these things. You know, if you look at the Middle East, if you look at the world in the 1960s, and you say, where are the big armed groups? You'd go to Latin America and East Asia, probably, and maybe Africa. And the Middle East looked like a ho-hum place with dictators and states and armies. And, you know, yes, you had the PLO, which was kind of a special case. So, first of all, it's not endemic to the Arab world or the Middle East, except when we look at certain eras. And I explained why right now, because of proxy war, failed states, and these narratives, it's flared up. Another thing I would like to sort of mention is, and maybe this is a bit, you know, to the side, but in a sense, there's no such thing as a terrorist group. There are movements who are political movements, from ISIS to everybody. These are movements that have their goals and they are, you know, committed to them. They use violence against civilians as one of the tools. And this phenomenon of calling entire movements terrorists and hence categorizing them as some different animal is a modern phenomenon. And it comes largely from the Israel-Arab conflict, where PLO, it's a terrorist group. Hezbollah is a terrorist group. PKK, the Turks and the Americans say, is a terrorist group. And that obfuscates what we're dealing with, which is contestation over state and power and narrative and identity and so on. And hence, when we say terrorists, in today's world, we think of what we've called terrorists, which have largely been in the Middle East. We didn't call the Chinese Communist Party, which did a lot of violence to achieve its political goals, we don't call them a terrorist movement because it was a different time.
Actually, I would disagree on this point with both Dr. Sham and with you, Paul, because actually the word terrorist in Arabic is Irhab. There has been a movement within the jihadi sphere to claim appropriate and boast that Irhab is indeed us, because after all, it's a Quranic principle. The whole notion, من رباط الخيل ترهبون عدو الله وعدوكم, the notion that Irhab is having the others fear you. Irhab is not randomly killing. Irhab is having the other fear you. They use tarwiya for the other one. Here again, it's a matter of semantics, but it becomes important because of what comes next. As a matter of fact, and this is an argument that I've made and I need to make here in this context, in the 19th century, it did appear, after the values of the Enlightenment, notions from the Enlightenment, reached the Middle East, that they were inherently accepted. Communes in Europe were replicated in the Middle East as ammiyat, which indeed exactly means communes. When the nation-state system was created, yes, you had a certain ideological elite that wanted more, but the bulk of the population actually was happy with the notion that they're moving towards something that is universal. We have developed the universal in the course of the 20th century, and with the collapse of the Soviet Union, declared the universal victorious and started talking about the right to protect and the responsibility to protect, and then we dropped the whole thing. So to a large extent, we have lost the universal. And this is a space, like Paul was saying, give me a state that has failed and I'll give you. He did not want to give you, but I'll show you a terrorist movement. I would say, give me a society in which the universal is no longer there, and I can show you also how the seeds of a terrorist movement can be born. Having lost the universal by what is widely perceived as hypocrisy, when President Obama cries for the Italian victim of a U.S. drone in Yemen, cries on TV, and is mute and completely agnostic about the dozens upon dozens, hundreds upon hundreds of Yemeni victims, that's losing the universal. When we declare ISIS, which deliberately kill tens of thousands of people, the greatest threat to humanity, and condone, or for that matter, as in the case of the gas attack, actually engage a regime that had killed people by an order of magnitude more, we have lost the universal. And therefore, we can see people saying, and actually this is the argument made in radical circles, that notion of the notions of human rights, the notion of universalism, this is pure a hoax. This is not true. This is purely in order for that crusading West to attack us once again in other forms. If we do not restore the universal, and here I'm as if I'm saying, therefore, the cultural is important. Yeah, absolutely it's important, but it's not the cultural that paternalizes the other and tries to seek from the toolkit of the other some formula that would work for us. No, the cultural here is if we do not live by the values that we proclaim, we cannot expect that other, in this case ISIS and all the others, to effectively try to fit any model we give them. But there has been severe danger, severe damage as a result of that departure. I'm not attributing the damage simply to the loss of the universal. There's a process within an incomplete modernity in Islam. Islam as an institution, not as lived Islam, not the Islam of the people. Islam of the scholastic institution has not been able to generate neither a Copenhagen school that questioned the roots of the place, nor a historical Muhammad that tries to look whether we can have multiple reading. Quite the opposite. There has been a scientism in Salafism, a historicism in Salafism that's too rigid, that's kind of von Ranke type historicism, along the lines that it is what it is, and anyone who departs from this vision is actually denying truth, truth with a capital T. So in a certain sense, it is this, if you'd like, incomplete assimilation of modernity that contributes to the rigidity that we see, all the way that, when I say all of this just in order to underline, from the point of ISIS, their official position was that they will treat the Syrians as if they were Muslims. This is the position. نُعَامِلُهُمْ مُعَامَلَةَ الْمُسْلِمِينَ. They did not say they were Muslims. They do not accept that the Syrians were Muslims. They will treat them as if they were, while radicals within them would insist, no, you cannot do that. And actually, we have footage of an Uzbek man going into a mosque and quizzing people about tenets of Islam, and when they fail to answer, killing them. And that is a figure from ISIS. So that level of depravity which has been structured is a result of notions that, in a certain sense, the hypocrisy at our end has contributed to.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating and depressing.
Charles, I wanted to say one thing about the issue of use of force, or some cases called adhab, or terror, or awe, or so on, that as a tool, it is in the essence of political movements and certainly states. I mean, whether the Machiavellian idea of, you know, basically rule is based on fear, or Thomas Hobbes' whole theory of the social contract is based on the most terrifying and terrible sovereign, so feared that you submit to him, and that's how stability is created. To modern times, when states use exceeding force, whether it's shock and awe somewhere or collective punishment somewhere else, that the instrumentalization of terror in order to get submission and get your way is a very generic thing that is used by political movements, by states, and used by these groups, whether it's ISIS and others, it is integral to how they impose their force and their rule. But I'm just warning that there is a facility sometimes to say, oh, well, that group is a terrorist group, as if that explains what they want or who they are. I'm just making that distinction, that the use of force and terrifying people is an ancient way of in all politics.
Sure. Absolutely.
I just wanted to make a statement. I would agree with, I believe both of you were questioning the whole idea of the terrorist groups as designated by various countries. Obviously, the United States, you will find yourself on the terrorist watch list if you threaten an ally, which is why the PKK is there. Mm-hmm. But you know, this doesn't have anything to do with an actual definition of what a terrorist movement really is, which is why I agree with you that it just doesn't make sense to even speak about terrorist groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely a political term. Please, Alan. Yes, it's coming.
Coming your way.
Thank you. I'm Alan Kieswetter, and I'm a scholar here at the Middle East Institute. And I have two questions, one for Sandra. How does the concept of relative deprivation figure into your analysis? And is that the difference you perceive between grievance and injustice? And for Paul, what is legitimacy? What is the definition that you use? When I write about it, I use the implicit, or I use the definition of the explicit or the implicit consent of the governed. And it could come from elections, it could come from respect for authority, political or religious, and a whole variety of factors. But I think you need a definition there to give a little more focus to your ideas. And by the way, I think the discussion is just excellent. I like it very, very much. And thank you all for your work and your comments.
Good. Thank you so much. Other questions? Yes, this lady right here.
Thank you. I'm Diane Perlman, George Mason School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution, and also for purpose here, Center for the Study of Ethnopolitical Conflict, and I'm interdisciplinary social scientist. So some aspects that were suggested but maybe not made so explicit is gender and patriarchal authoritarian cultures, and which I've dread of the feminine, and extreme gender splitting are associated with violence, and also things like culture of honor, which is also associated with humiliation and, say, loss of glory, like loss of the Ottoman Empire or the South here, and the humiliation of that, physical punishment in childhood, and also humiliation on an individual level, but also collective level trauma, and asymmetric, you know, it's like warfare of the weak, so dynamics of asymmetric conflict are involved there. And in terms of policy, Charles, I like your question about implications for policy. And one is, like, you know, having American bases in Muslim countries is also experienced as humiliating, and that's a policy implication. And when you attack people on their identity, it increases their identity and fear as well. So reducing tension and fear.
Okay, great. Thank you. One more question. We'll get to this gentleman at the back who's had his hand up for a while as well, I think. Do a lightning round after this, I hope.
Hi, I'm Cassandra Bays, a retired social work professor. The role of religion, education, in terms of ideology and acculturation. This is a region that has three very charged faiths. And there is the idea that my God is better than yours among the three religions. And then political occupation in the region, which has fueled the tension between the three religions. And we still do not know how do we deal with teaching children and adults, and on the media, how do you socialize people to respect the religion of the other and to interpret the text. We're still very, very literal in interpreting the religious text. And that is a cultural problem of special significance in the Middle East.
Thank you so much. Open up to the panel.
Well, I, first to answer your question about relative deprivation, of course, doing CBE work, that comes up quite frequently. Basically, it's just assuming that the idea that you are in a lower position than people around you, even though you may not be in terms of poverty absolutely poor, it's considered to be part of the radicalization process. I would have to say, though, that we did have a lot of psychologists who came in to consult with us when I was working on the State Department program, and they all came to the same conclusion. There's no such thing as a terrorist profile, which I think goes to, or extremist profile. There is no such thing. I mean, you cannot assume that an individual will, because of certain traits, because they were physically punished as a child or whatever, that this person will automatically trigger violence. Obviously, that should be obvious to almost everyone, and I'm sure everyone has thought that, but they've done a lot of research in order to come to that obvious conclusion. So let's see, I think someone else had asked about, oh, you were asked about the gender aspects. I think that... In terms of the subjugation and mistreatment of women being sort of concomitant with extremism, is that the point you were? I'm not sure.
Exactly. Yeah. Patriarchal authoritarianism, your commission to authority and punished.
Well, I mean, there is the fact that women, you know, have been extremists, have been suicide bombers, have participated in this movement. They're certainly very, very prominent in the Kurdish movement. But
culture, not individual.
In a patriarchal culture. In anthropology, basically, most people don't necessarily accept that there are honor and shame cultures, that there are various permutations of these concepts in different cultures. But there's no such thing as a culture that is just based entirely on honor. and that leads to a patriarchal structure, which actually leads to violence. I guess I would kind of disagree with that particular premise. So.
I would add, in terms of the issues of gender, the need for real, detailed study of an experiment such as the Islamic State before we simply assume that it's absolute patriarchy effectively completely muzzled and muted women. And I'm saying that because as rigid and as intransigent as it was, for many women it seems to have been less so than the societies from which they came. And for that matter, within the structures, even the official structures of the Islamic State, which were segregated completely, meaning sort of in literally thousands upon thousands of video publications, video releases from the Islamic State, not one woman. Okay, you do not see one woman. Nonetheless, behind that, there was a number of women organizations. Hafidat Aisha is one of them, for example, that was very active. There was influential women in the Islamic State that actually had fatwas that affected the whole landscape. For example, Sumayya, who was married to Turki bin Ali from Bahrain and who basically issued a fatwa allowing women married to a Nusra man to leave their husbands, and many did. You see, so the idea here is, again, as we're talking here about an entity, the Islamic State, that is so alien to us, but, I mean, to simply assume that in certain ways there was no women's voice in it, I think requires some qualifications.
The question that Alan was... the issue of legitimacy, obviously, how do you define it, how do you measure it? It's a very interesting discussion because there's all kinds, there's continuums of that, I suppose. But, I mean, what I'm referring to as a reality that Certainly, as we saw things evolve from the 60s in the Arab, most of the Arab countries, to the 90s, you had the decreasing ability of governments, regimes, states to, without repression, command the loyalty and cooperation of their people. So that balance between Abd al-Nasser, who when he threatened to resign, millions came out on the streets to plead with him not to, that sort of loyalty and charisma in his case, but even in other cases when people accepted military leaders because they had hopes that they would in the future get X, Y, and Z. Also, you know, schools were being opened, they were getting public sector jobs, things were improving for them. So they followed willingly. To the decline that I was beginning to describe in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, where people no longer were following willingly, so you had to have increased measures of repression. And they delved into false democracy. So they felt, well, we've got to hold an election to at least make it seem that we were elected. So they were recognizing that they were having problems of legitimacy. To the Arab Spring, where by that point it was clear that big sectors of the population were putting up with the regime on a hairbreadth of wanting to revolt. And those things matter. So I do think there was a very serious decline of legitimacy, although it's very hard to define it in black and white. The only thing I want to say, and maybe, I mean, I've said it, but about sort of the gender issue, is about the fundamental shifts in power. That this is not it's not simply an issue of culture and so on. It is an entire historical power structure where men, and particularly older men, had power and money and land and real estate and knowledge, had everything, and young people and women did not, to a new distribution of power in society where that is no longer the case. And we saw that how youth are challenging, and we see that how women, whether they are organizing themselves into movements, in some cases they do, in some cases they don't, but simply that they have knowledge and they have power. And we've seen reactions to that, either to push it back or to give it a place where it can be. And here's where, you know, it might be have a, you know, I mean, obviously ISIS needs to be studied further, but to my mind, it's clear that it's a massive pushback, but an attempt to say, yes, but of course women have a role. It's here. It's, you know, education or the household and so on. And other places, like in Tunisia, or maybe, hopefully, some, you know, little attempts of what MBS is doing is to get ahead of it. Well, women are now empowered. We can't keep them where they were, so may as well get ahead of it and let them do more. And I think that power shift is one way, and it's only going to be going in one way. On the issue of sort of education and religion and so on that was mentioned by Mr. Bayes, I mean, I also want to just throw on the table that when you look at the 20th century, the first part of the 20th century, religion was the quiescent, the non-change-oriented. That's what was non-dangerous and non-revolution. All the armed violent movements and the revolution, they were all secular, whether they were nationalists or communists or anything. Radicalization was widespread, and all of it, or almost all of it, was not related to religion. So it's interesting that now we live in a world in the Middle East, maybe after the 70s, Islamic Revolution in Iran, shift in Saudi Arabia and others, and the failure of Arab nationalism, socialism, and all of that, it looks like radicalization is linked to religion. So that tells me that the causes really are structural, and anybody can instrumentalize Karl Marx or the Quran, or I'd always like to cite the case of a radical religious group that took over a city, beheaded people, enslaved the women. That was a group of Protestant Mennonites in Munster, Germany in 1635. So you can instrumentalize anything to, you know, when you're really upset about something and the structure around you is no longer serving you.
To your point, I would say when we were working in Bangladesh and studying the history of extremism there, there was a period of time in which the extremism was all leftist movements, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden it sort of started to switch over to a more religiously oriented type of extremism.
No, definitely all kinds. I'm really sorry. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to be able to take any more questions. We are out of time. I've posed the panelists lots of challenges, so if you do have any other questions, I would challenge you to challenge the panelists on their way out, if you can manage it. But I'm sure you'll
but
agree.
But not in a violent way.
I'm sure you'll agree it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much again for coming over to the Middle East Institute. And yes, round of applause.
Thank you.